in Desatoya Ranch Estates on 6219 Deserts End Road, where lumber was stacked in some of the yards and sand blew in the streets, we turned into the driveway of a large Spanish-looking house, or maybe it was Moorish, shuttered beige stucco with arched gables and a clay-tiled roof pitched at various startling angles. I was impressed by the aimlessness and sprawl of it, its cornices and columns, the elaborate ironwork door with its sense of a stage set, like a house from one of the Telemundo soap operas the doorman always had going in the package room. As we got out of the car and were circling around to the garage entrance with our suitcases, I heard an eerie, distressing noise, screaming or crying from inside the house. "Gosh, what's that?" I said, dropping my bags, unnerved. Zandra was leaning sideways, stumbling a bit in her high shoes and grappling for her key. "Oh, shut up, shut up, shut the fuck up," she was muttering under her breath. Before she'd opened the door all the way, an hysterical, stringy mop shot out, shrieking, and began to hop and dance and caper all around us. "Get down!" Zandra was yelling. Through the half-open door, safari music, trumpeting elephants, chattering monkeys, was playing so loud that I could hear it all the way out in the garage. "Wow," I said, peering inside. The air inside smelled hot and stale. Old cigarette smoke, new carpet, and no question about it, dog shit.
"For the zookeeper, big cats pose a unique series of challenges," the voice on the television boomed. "Why don't we follow Andrea and her staff on their morning rounds?"
"Hey," I said, stopping in the door with my bag. "You left the television on."
"No," said Zandra, brushing past me. "That's Animal Planet. I left it on for him. For Popper. I said get down!"
She snapped at the dog, who was scrabbling at her knees with his claws, and she hobbled in on her platforms and switched the television off.
"He stayed by himself?"
I said, over the dog's shrieks. He was one of those long-haired, girly dogs who would have been white and fluffy if he was clean.
"Oh, he's got a drinking fountain from Petco," said Zandra, wiping her forehead with the back of her hand as she stepped over the dog. "And one of those big feeder things."
"What kind is he?"
"Maltese. Purebred. I want him in a raffle. I mean, I know he needs a bath. It's a pain to keep them groomed." "That's right. Just look what you did to my pants," she said to the dog. "White jeans."
We were standing in a large, open room with high ceilings and a staircase that ran up to a sort of railed mezzanine on one side, a room almost as big as the entire apartment I'd grown up in. But when my eyes adjusted from the bright sun, I was taken aback by how bare it was. Bone-white walls, stone fireplace with sort of a fake hunting lodge feel, sofa like something from a hospital waiting room. Across from the glass patio doors stretched a wall of built-in shelves, mostly empty. My dad creaked in and dropped the suitcases on the carpet.
"Jesus, Zan, it smells like shit in here."
Zandra, leaning over to set down her purse, winced as the dog began to jump and climb and claw all over her.
"Well, Janet was supposed to come and let him out,"
she said over his high-pitched screams.
"She had the key and everything." "God, Popper," she said, wrinkling her nose, turning her head away. "You stink!"
The emptiness of the place stunned me. Until that moment, I had never questioned the necessity of selling my mother's books and rugs and antiques, or the need of sending almost everything else to Goodwill or the garbage. I had grown up in a four-room apartment where closets were packed to overflowing, where every bed had boxes beneath it, and pots and pans were hung from the ceiling because there wasn't room in the cupboards. But how easy it would have been to bring some of her things, like the silver box that had been her mother's, or the painting of a chestnut mare that looked like a Stubbs, or even her childhood copy of Black Beauty. It wasn't even as if he couldn't have used a few good pictures or some of the furniture she'd inherited from her parents. He had gotten rid of her things because he hated her.
Jesus Christ, my father was saying, his voice raised angrily over the shrill barks. This dog has destroyed the place, quite honestly.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I know it's a mess, but Janet said,
I told you you should have kenneled this dog. Or, I don't know, taken him to the pound. I don't like having him in the house. Outdoors is the place for him.
Didn't I tell you this was going to be a problem? Janet is such a fucking flake. So he went on the rug a few times. So what? And what the hell are you looking at?
Said Xandra angrily, stepping over the shrieking dog. And with a bit of a start, I realized it was me she was glaring at. 6. My new room felt so bare and lonely that after I unpacked my bags, I left the sliding door of the closet open so I could see my clothes hanging inside. Downstairs, I could still hear Dad shouting about the carpet. Unfortunately, Xandra was shouting too, getting him more wound up, which I could have told her if she'd asked, was exactly the wrong way to handle him. At home, my mother had known how to suffocate my dad's anger by growing silent, a low, unwavering flame of contempt that sucked all the oxygen out of the room and made everything he said and did seem ridiculous. Eventually, he would whoosh out with a thunderous slam of the front door, and when he returned, hours later, with a quiet click of the key in the lock, he would walk around the apartment as if nothing had happened, going to the refrigerator for a beer, asking in a perfectly normal voice where his mail was. Of the 3 empty rooms upstairs, I'd chosen the largest, which, like a hotel room, had its own tiny bathroom to the side. Floor heavily carpeted in steel blue plush, bare mattress with a plastic package of bedsheets at the foot. Legends per kale, 20% off. A gentle, mechanical hum emanated from the walls, like the hum of an aquarium filter. It seemed like the kind of room where a call girl or a stewardess would be murdered on television. With an ear out for Dad and Xandra, I sat on the mattress with the wrapped painting on my knees. Even with the door locked, I was hesitant to take the paper off in case they came upstairs, and yet the desire to look at it was irresistible. Carefully, carefully, I scratched the tape with my thumbnail and peeled it up by the edges. The painting slid out more easily than I'd expected, and I found myself biting back a gasp of pleasure. It was the first time I'd seen the painting in the light of day. In the arid room, all sheetrock and whiteness, the muted colors bloomed with life, and even though the surface of the painting was ghosted ever so slightly with dust, the atmosphere it breathed was like the light-rinsed airiness of a wall opposite an open window. Was this why people like Mrs. Swanson went on about the desert light? She had loved to warble on about what she called her sojourn in New Mexico. Wide horizons, empty skies, spiritual clarity. Yet, as if by some trick of the light, the painting seemed transfigured, as the dark roofline view of water tanks from my mother's bedroom window sometimes stood gilded and electrified for a few strange moments in the stormlight of late afternoon, right before a summer cloudburst.
Theo?
My dad, knocking briskly at the door.
You hungry?
I stood up, hoping he wouldn't try the door and find it locked. My new room was as bare as a jail cell, but the closet had high shelves, well above my dad's eye level, very deep.
I'm going to pick up some Chinese. Want me to get you something?
Would my dad know what the painting was, if he saw it? I hadn't thought so, but looking at it in the light, the glow it threw off, I realized that any fool would.
Be right there,
I called, my voice false-sounding and hoarse, slipping the painting into an extra pillowcase and hiding it under the bed before hurrying out of the room. 7. In the months in Las Vegas before school started, loitering around downstairs with the earphones of my iPod in but the sound off, I learned a number of interesting facts. For starters, My dad's former job had not involved nearly as much business travel to Chicago and Phoenix as he had led us to believe. Unbeknownst to my mother and me, he had actually been flying out to Vegas for some months, and it was in Vegas, in an Asian-themed bar at the Bellagio, that he and Zandra had met. They had been seeing each other for a while before my dad vanished, a bit over a year, as I gathered. It seemed that they had celebrated their anniversary not long before my mother died, with dinner at Delmonico's Steakhouse and the John Bon Jovi concert at the MGM Grand. Bon Jovi. Of all the many things I was dying to tell my mother, and there were thousands of them, if not millions, it seemed terrible that she would never know this hilarious fact. Another thing I figured out, after a few days in the house on Desert End Road, what Zandra and my dad really meant when they said my dad had stopped drinking was that he'd switched from scotch, his beverage of choice, to Corona Lights and Vicodin. I had been puzzled by how frequently the peace sign, or V for victory, was flashed between them, in all sorts of incongruous contexts, and it might have gone on being a mystery for a lot longer if my dad hadn't just come out and asked Zandra for a Vicodin when he thought I wasn't listening. I didn't know anything about Vicodin, except that it was something that a wild movie actress I liked was always getting her picture in the tabloids about. Stumbling from her Mercedes as police lights flashed in the background. Several days later, I came across a plastic bag with what looked like about 300 pills in it, sitting on the kitchen counter alongside a bottle of my dad's Propecia and a stack of unpaid bills, which Sandra snatched up and threw in her purse. "What are those?" I said.
Vitamins.
"Why are they in that baggie like that?"
"I get them from this bodybuilder guy at work."
The weird thing was, and this was something else I wished I could have discussed with my mother, the new, drugged-out dad was a much more pleasant and predictable companion than the dad of old. When my father drank, he was a twist of nerves, all inappropriate jokes and aggressive bursts of energy, right up until the moment he passed out. But when he stopped drinking, he was worse. He blasted along 10 paces ahead of my mother and me on the sidewalk, talking to himself and patting his suit pockets as if for a weapon. He brought home stuff we didn't want and couldn't afford, like crocodile Manolos for my mother, who hated high heels, and not even in the right size. He lugged piles of paper home from the office and sat up past midnight drinking iced coffee and punching in numbers on the calculator, sweat pouring off him like he'd just done 40 minutes on the Stairmaster. Or else he would make a big deal of going to some party way the hell over in Brooklyn. "What do you mean, maybe I shouldn't go? You think I should live like a fucking hermit? Is that it?" And then, after dragging my mother there, storm out 10 minutes later after insulting someone or mocking them to their face. This was a different, more affable energy with the pills. A combination of sluggishness and brightness, a bemused, goofy, floating quality. His walk was looser, he napped more, nodded agreeably, lost the thread of his arguments, ambled about barefoot with his bathrobe halfway open. From his genial cursing, his infrequent shaving, the relaxed way he talked around the cigarette in the corner of his mouth, it was almost as if he was playing a character, some cool guy from a 50s noir, or maybe Ocean's 11, a lazy, sated gangster with not much to lose. Yet even in the midst of his new laid-backness, he still had that crazed and slightly heroic look of schoolboy insolence, all the more stirring since it was drifting towards autumn, half-ruined and careless of itself. In the house on Desert's End Road, which had the super-expensive cable television package my mother would never let us get, he drew the blinds against the glare and sat smoking in front of the television, glassy as an opium addict, watching ESPN with the sound off, no sport in particular, anything and everything that came on, cricket, highlife, badminton, croquet. The air was overly chilled, with a stale, refrigerated smell. Sitting motionless for hours, the filament of smoke from his Viceroy floating to the ceiling like a thread of incense, He might as well have been contemplating the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha as the leaderboard at the PGA or whatever. What wasn't clear was if my dad had a job, or if he did, what kind of job it was. The phone rang all hours of the day and night. My dad went in the hallway with the handset, his back to me, bracing his arm against the wall and staring at the carpet as he talked, something in his posture suggesting the attitude of a coach at the end of a tough game. Usually, he kept his voice well down, but even when he didn't, it was tough to understand his end of the conversation. Vig, money line, odds-on favorite, straight up and against the spread. He was gone much of the time, on unexplained errands, and a lot of nights he and Zandra didn't come home at all.
"We get comped a lot at the MGM Grand," he explained, rubbing his eyes, sinking back into the sofa cushions with an exhausted sigh. And again I got a sense of the character he was playing. Moody playboy, relic of the 80s, easily bored.
"I hope you don't mind. It's just when she's working the late shift, it's easier for us to crash on the strip."
8.
"What are all these papers everywhere?" I asked Zandra one day while she was in the kitchen making her white diet drink. I was confused by the pre-printed cards I kept finding all over the house, grids penciled in with row after monotonous row of figures. Vaguely scientific-looking, they had a creepy feel of DNA sequences, or maybe spy transmissions in binary code. She switched the blender off, flicked the hair out of her eyes.
"Excuse me?
These worksheets, or whatever."
"Baccarat,"
said Zandra, rolling the R, doing a tricky little fillip with her fingers.
"Oh," I said, after a flat pause, though I'd never heard the word before. She stuck her finger in the drink and licked it off.
"We go to the Baccarat salon at the MGM Grand a lot," she said. "Your dad likes to keep track of his played games."
"Can I go sometime?"
"No." "Well, yeah, I guess you could," she said, as if I'd inquired about vacation prospects in some unstable Islamic nation. "Except they're not super welcoming of kids in the casinos. You're not really allowed to come and watch us play."
So what, I thought. Standing around and watching Dad and Zandra gamble was scarcely my idea of fun. Aloud, I said, "But I thought they had tigers and pirate boats and things like that."
"Yeah, well, I guess."
She was reaching up for a glass on her shelf, exposing a quadrangle of blue-inked Chinese characters between her t-shirt and her low-slung jeans.
"They tried to sell this whole family-friendly package a few years ago, but it didn't wash."
9. I might have liked Zandra in other circumstances, which, I guess, is sort of like saying I might have liked the kid who beat me up if he hadn't beat me up. She was my first inkling that women over 40, women maybe not all that great-looking to start with, could be sexy, though she wasn't pretty in the face. Bullet eyes, blunt little nose, tiny teeth. Still, she was in shape. She worked out, and her arms and legs were so glossy and tan that they almost looked sprayed, as if she anointed herself with lots of creams and oils. Teetering in her high shoes, she walked fast, always tugging at her too short skirt, a forward-leaning walk, weirdly alluring. On some level, I was repelled by her stuttery voice, her thick, shiny lip gloss that came in a tube that said lip glass, by the multiple pierce holes in her ears and the gap in her front teeth that she liked to worry with her tongue. But there was something sultry and exciting and tough about her, too, an animal strength, a purring, prowling quality when she was out of her heels and walking barefoot. Vanilla Coke, vanilla chapstick, vanilla diet drink, Stoli vanilla. Off from work, she dressed like sort of a wrapped-up tennis mom. Short white skirts, lots of gold jewelry. Even her tennis shoes were new and spanking white. Sunbathing by the pool, she wore a white crocheted bikini. Her back was wide but thin, lots of ribs, like a man without his shirt on.
"Uh-oh, wardrobe malfunction," she said,
when she sat up from the lounge chair without remembering to fasten her top, and I saw that her breasts were as tan as the rest of her. She liked reality shows, Survivor, American Idol. She liked to shop at Intermix and Juicy Couture. She liked to call her friend Courtney and vent, and a lot of her venting, unfortunately, was on the subject of me.
Can you believe it?
I heard her saying on the telephone when my dad was out of the house one day.
I didn't sign on for this. A kid? Hello? Yeah, it's a pain in the ass, all right,
she continued, inhaling lazily on her Marlboro Light, pausing by the glass doors that led to the pool, staring down at her freshly painted honeydew green toenails.
Now,
she said after a brief pause,
I don't know how long for. I mean, what does he expect me to think? I'm not a freaking soccer mom.
Her complaint seemed routine, not particularly heated or personal. Still, it was hard to know just how to make her like me. Previously, I had operated on the assumption that mom-aged women loved it when you stood around and tried to talk to them, but with Xandra, I soon learned that it was better not to joke around or inquire too much about her day when she came home in a bad mood. Sometimes, when it was just the two of us, she switched the channel from ESPN and we sat eating fruit cocktail and watching movies on Lifetime peacefully enough. But when she was annoyed with me, she had a cold way of saying, apparently, in answer to almost anything I said, making me feel stupid.
I can't find the can opener. Apparently.
There's going to be a lunar eclipse tonight.
Apparently.
Look, sparks are coming out of the wall socket.
Apparently.
Xandra worked nights. Usually she breezed off around 3:30 in the afternoon, dressed in her curvy work uniform. Black jacket, black pants, made of some stretchy, tight-fitting material, with her blouse unbuttoned to her freckled breastbone. The name tag pinned to her blazer said Xandra in big letters, and underneath, Florida. In New York, when we'd been out at dinner that night, she told me that she was trying to break into real estate, but what she really did, I soon learned, was manage a bar called Nichols in a casino on the Strip. Sometimes she came home with plastic platters of bar snacks wrapped in cellophane, things like meatballs and chicken teriyaki bites, which she and my dad carried in front of the television and ate with the sound off. Living with them was like living with roommates I didn't particularly get along with. When they were at home, I stayed in my room with the door shut, and when they were gone, which was most of the time, I prowled through the farther reaches of the house, trying to get used to its openness. Many of the rooms were bare of furniture, or almost bare, and the open space, the uncurtained brightness, all exposed carpet and parallel planes, made me feel slightly unmoored. And yet, it was a relief not to feel constantly exposed or on stage, the way I had at the barber's. The sky was a rich, mindless, never-ending blue, like a promise of some ridiculous glory that wasn't really there. No one cared that I never changed my clothes and wasn't in therapy. I was free to goof off, lie in bed all morning, watch 5 Robert Mitchum movies in a row if I felt like it. Dad and Xandra kept their bedroom door locked, which was too bad, as that was the room where Xandra kept her laptop, off limits to me unless she was home, and she brought it down for me to use in the living room. Poking around when they were out of the house, I found real estate leaflets, new wine glasses still in the box, a stack of old TV guides, a cardboard box of beat-up trade paperbacks, Your Moon Signs, The South Beach Diet, Caro's Book of Poker Tells, Lovers and Players by Jackie Collins. The houses around us were empty, no neighbors. 5 or 6 houses down, on the opposite side of the street, there was an old Pontiac parked out front. It belonged to a tired-looking woman with big boobs and ratty hair, whom I sometimes saw standing barefoot out in front of her house in the late afternoon, clutching a pack of cigarettes and talking on her cell phone. I thought of her as the playa, as the first time I'd seen her, she'd been wearing a t-shirt that said, "Don't hate the playa, hate the game." Apart from her, the playa, the only other living person I'd seen on our street was a big-bellied man in a black sports shirt way the hell down at the cul-de-sac, wheeling a garbage can out to the curb. Although I could have told him, No garbage pickup on our street. When it was time to take the trash out, Zandra made me sneak out with the bag and throw it in the dumpster of the abandoned, under-construction house a few doors down. At night, apart from our house and the playas, complete darkness reigned on the street. It was all as isolated as a book we'd read in the third grade about pioneer children on the Nebraska prairie, except with no siblings or friendly farm animals, or Ma and Pa. The hardest thing, by far, was being stuck in the middle of nowhere. No movie theaters or libraries, not even a corner store. "Isn't there a bus or something?" I asked Zandra one evening when she was in the kitchen, unwrapping the night's plastic tray of atomic wings and blue cheese dip.
"Bus?"
said Zandra, licking a smear of barbecue sauce off her finger.
"Don't you have public transportation out here?"
"Nope."
"What do people do?"
Zandra cocked her head to the side.
"They drive?"
she said, as if I was a retard who'd never heard of cars. One thing, there was a pool. My first day I'd burned myself brick red within an hour and suffered a sleepless night on scratchy new sheets. After that, I only went out after the sun started going down. The twilights out there were florid and melodramatic, great sweeps of orange and crimson, and Lawrence in the desert vermilion, the night dropping dark and hard like a slammed door. Zandra's dog, Popper, who lived, for the most part, in a brown plastic igloo on the shady side of the fence, ran back and forth along the side of the pool, yapping as I floated on my back, trying to pick out constellations I knew in the confusing white spatter of stars. Orion, Cassiopeia the Queen, Whiplash Scorpius with the twin stings in his tail, all the friendly childhood patterns that had twinkled me to sleep from the glow-in-the-dark planetarium stars on my bedroom ceiling back in New York. Now, transfigured, cold and glorious like deities with their disguises flung off, it was as if they'd flown through the roof and into the sky to assume their true celestial homes. 10. My school started the second week of August. From a distance, the fenced complex of long, low, sand-colored buildings, connected by roofed walkways, made me think of a minimum security prison. But once I stepped through the doors, the brightly colored posters and the echoing hallway were like falling back into a familiar old dream of school. Crowded stairwells, humming lights, biology classroom with an iguana and a piano-sized tank, locker-lined halls that were familiar like a set from some much-watched television show. And though the resemblance to my old school was only superficial, on some strange wavelength, it was also comforting and real. The other section of Honors English was reading Great Expectations. Mine was reading Walden, and I hid myself in the coolness and silence of the book, a refuge from the sheet metal glare of the desert. During the morning break, where we were rounded up and made to go outside, in a chain-fenced yard near the vending machines, I stood in the shadiest corner I could find with my mass-market paperback and, with a red pencil, went through and underlined a lot of particularly bracing sentences. The mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation. A stereotyped but unconscious despair is concealed even under what are called the games and amusements of mankind. What would Thoreau have made of Las Vegas, its lights and rackets, its trash and daydreams, its projections and hollow facades? At my school, the sense of transience was unsettling. There were a lot of army brats, a lot of foreigners, many of them the children of executives who had come to Las Vegas for big managerial and construction jobs. Some of them had lived in 9 or 10 different states in as many years, and many of them had lived abroad, in Sydney, Caracas, Beijing, Dubai, Taipei. There were also a good many shy, half-invisible boys and girls whose parents had fled rural hardship for jobs as hotel busboys and chambermaids. In this new ecosystem, money, or even good looks, did not seem to determine popularity. What mattered most, as I came to realize, was who'd lived in Vegas the longest, which was why the knockdown Mexican beauties and itinerant construction heirs sat alone at lunch, while the bland, middling children of local realtors and car dealers were the cheerleaders and class presidents, the unchallenged elite of the school. The days were clear and beautiful, and as September rolled around, the hateful glare gave way to a certain luminosity, a dusty, golden quality. Sometimes I ate lunch at the Spanish table to practice my Spanish. Sometimes I ate lunch at the German table, even though I didn't speak German, because several of the German 2 kids, children of Deutsche Bank and Lufthansa executives, had grown up in New York. Of my classes, English was the only one I looked forward to, yet I was disturbed by how many of the classmates disliked Thoreau, railed against him even, as if he, who claimed never to have learned anything of value from an old person, was an enemy and not a friend. His scorn of commerce, invigorating to me, nettled a lot of the more vocal kids in honors English.
"Yeah, right,"
shouted an obnoxious boy whose hair was gelled and combed stiff like a Dragon Ball Z character.
"Some kind of world it would be if everybody just dropped out and moped around in the woods."
"Me, me, me,"
whined a voice in the back.
"It's antisocial,"
a loudmouth girl interjected eagerly over the laughter that followed this, shifting in her seat, turning back to the teacher, a limp, long-boned woman named Mrs. Spear, who always wore brown sandals and earth-tone colors and looked as if she was suffering from major depression.
"Thoreau is always just sitting around on his can telling us how good he has it."
"Because," said the Dragon Ball Z boy, his voice rising gleefully, "if everybody dropped out, like he's saying to do, what kind of community would we have if it was just people like him? We wouldn't have hospitals and stuff. We wouldn't have roads."
"Twat," mumbled a welcome voice, just loud enough for everybody around to hear. I turned to see who had said this, the burnout-looking boy across the aisle, slouched and drumming his desk with his fingers. When he saw me looking at him, he raised a surprisingly lively eyebrow, as if to say, "Can you believe these fucking idiots?"
"Did someone have something to say back there?"
said Mrs. Spear.
"Like Thoreau gave a toss about roads,"
said the burnout boy. His accent took me by surprise. Foreign. I couldn't place it.
"Thoreau was the first environmentalist," said Mrs. Spear.
"He was also the first vegetarian,"
said a girl in back.
"Figures," said someone else. "Mr. Crunchy Chewy."
"You're all totally missing my point,"
the Dragon Ball Z boy said excitedly.
"Somebody has to build roads and not just sit in the woods looking at ants and mosquitoes all day. It's called civilization."
My neighbor let out a sharp, contemptuous bark of a laugh. He was pale and thin, not very clean, with lank, dark hair falling in his eyes, and the unwholesome wanness of a runaway, calloused hands and black-circled nails chewed to the nub, not like the shiny-haired, ski-tanned skate rats from my school on the Upper West Side, punks whose dads were CEOs and Park Avenue surgeons, but a kid who might conceivably be sitting on a sidewalk somewhere with a stray dog on a rope.
"Well, to address some of these questions, I'd like for everybody to turn back to page 15,
Mrs. Spear said,
"where Thoreau is talking about his experiment in living."
"Experiment how?"
said Dragon Ball Z.
"Why is living in the woods like he does any different from a caveman?"
The dark-haired boy scowled and sank deeper in his seat. He reminded me of the homeless-looking kids who stood around passing cigarettes back and forth on St. Mark's Place, comparing scars, begging for change. Same torn-up clothes and scrawny white arms. Same black leather bracelets tangled at the wrists. Their multi-layered complexity was a sign I couldn't read, though the general import was clear enough. "Different tribe, forget about it. I'm way too cool for you. Don't even try to talk to me." Such was my mistaken first impression of the only friend I made when I was in Vegas, and, as it turned out, one of the great friends of my life. His name was Boris. Somehow, we found ourselves standing together in the crowd that was waiting for the bus after school that day.
"Ha! Harry Potter," he said as he looked me over.
"Fuck you," I said listlessly. It was not the first time in Vegas I'd heard the Harry Potter comment. My New York clothes, khakis, white Oxford shirts, the tortoiseshell glasses which I unfortunately needed to see, made me look like a freak at school, where most people dressed in tank tops and flip-flops.
"Where's your broomstick?"
"Left it at Hogwarts," I said.
"What about you? Where's your board?"
"Eh?"
he said, leaning into me and cupping his hand behind his ear with an old mannish, deaf-looking gesture. He was half a head taller than me, along with jungle boots and bizarre old fatigues with the knees busted out. He was wearing a ratted-up black t-shirt with a snowboarding logo, "Never Summer," in white gothic letters.
"Your shirt,"
I said with a curt nod.
"Not much boarding in the desert."
"Nah,"
said Boris, pushing the stringy dark hair out of his eyes.
"I don't know how to snowboard. I just hate the sun."
We ended up together on the bus, in the seat closest to the door, clearly an unpopular place to sit, judging from the urgent way other kids muscled and pushed to the rear. But I hadn't grown up riding a school bus, and apparently neither had he. As he too seemed to think it only natural to fling himself down in the first empty seat up front. For a while, we didn't say much, but it was a long ride, and eventually we got talking. It turned out that he lived in Canyon Shadows too, but farther out, the end that was getting reclaimed by the desert, where a lot of the houses weren't finished, and sand stood in the streets.
"How long have you been here?"
I asked him. It was the question all the kids asked each other at my new school, like we were doing jail time.
"Dunno. 2 months, maybe?"
Though he spoke English fluently enough, with a strong Australian accent, there was also a dark, slurry undercurrent of something else, a whiff of Count Dracula, or maybe it was KGB agent.
"Where are you from?"
"New York," I said, and was gratified at his silent double-take, his lowered eyebrows that said, "Very cool."
"What about you?"
He pulled a face.
"Well, let's see,"
he said, slumping back in his seat and counting off the countries on his fingers.
"I've lived in Russia, Scotland, which was maybe cool, but I don't remember it, Australia, Poland, New Zealand, Texas for 2 months, Alaska, New Guinea, Canada, Saudi Arabia, Sweden, Ukraine."
"Jesus Christ," he shrugged.
"Mostly Australia, Russia, and Ukraine, though. Those three places."
"Do you speak Russian?"
He made a gesture that I took to mean more or less.
"Ukrainian, too, and Polish. Though I've forgotten a lot. The other day I tried to remember what was the word for dragonfly, and couldn't."
"Say something."
He obliged, something spitty and guttural.
"What does that mean?"
He chortled.
"It means fuck you up the ass."
"Yeah? In Russian?"
He laughed, exposing grayish and very un-American teeth.
"Ukrainian. I thought they spoke Russian in the Ukraine." "Well, yes. Depends what part of Ukraine. They're not so different languages, the two." "Well..."
Click of the tongue, eye roll.
"Not so very much. Numbers are different, days of the week, some vocabulary. My name is spelled different in Ukrainian, but in North America it's easier to use Russian spelling and be Boris, not B-O-R-Y-S. In the West, everybody knows Boris Yeltsin."
He ticked his head to one side.
"Boris Becker. Boris Badenov."
"Eh?"
he said sharply, turning as if I'd insulted him.
"Bullwinkle? Boris and Natasha? Oh yes, Prince Boris. War and Peace. I'm named like him. Although the surname of Prince Boris is Drubetskoy, not what you said."
"So, what's your first language?
Ukrainian?"
He shrugged.
"Polish, maybe,"
he said, falling back in his seat, slinging his dark hair to one side with a flip of his head. His eyes were hard and humorous, very black.
"My mother was Polish, from Rzeszów,
near the Ukrainian border.
Russian, Ukrainian. Ukraine, as you know, was satellite of USSR, so I speak both. Maybe not Russian quite so much. It's best for swearing and cursing. With Slavic languages, Russian, Ukrainian, Polish, even Czech, if you know one, you sort of get drift in all. But for me, English is easiest now. Used to be the other way around. What do you think about America?
Everyone always smiles so big.
Well, most people. Maybe not so much you.
I think it looks stupid.
He was, like me, an only child. His father, born in Siberia, a Ukrainian national from Novoagansk, was in mining and exploration.
Big, important job. He travels the world.
Boris's mother, his father's second wife, was dead.
Mine too, I said.
He shrugged.
She's been dead for donkey's years, he said. She was an alky. She was drunk one night and she fell out a window and died.
Wow, I said, a bit stunned by how lightly he'd tossed this off.
Yeah, it sucks,
he said carelessly, looking out the window.
So, what nationality are you?
I said, after a brief silence.
Huh?
Well, if your mother's Polish and your dad's Ukrainian and you were born in Australia, that would make you...
Indonesian,
he said with a sinister smile. He had dark, devilish, very expressive eyebrows that moved around a lot when he spoke.
How's that?
Well, my passport says Ukraine, and I have part citizenship in Poland, too. But Indonesia is the place I want to get back to,
said Boris, tossing the hair out of his eyes.
PNG.
What?
Papua New Guinea. It's my favorite place I've lived.
New Guinea?
I thought they had headhunters. Not anymore. Well, not so many. This bracelet is from there,
he said, pointing to one of the many black leather strands on his wrist.
My friend Bami made it for me. He was our cook.
What's it like?
Not so bad,
he said, glancing at me sideways in his brooding, self-amused way.
I had a parrot and a pet goose and was learning to surf. But then, 6 months ago, my dad hauled me with him to this shabby town in Alaska, Seward Peninsula, just below Arctic Circle. And then, middle of May, we flew to Fairbanks on a prop plane, and then we came here.
Wow,
I said.
Dead boring up there, said Boris. Heaps of dead fish and bad internet connection. I should have run away. I wish I had,
he said bitterly. And done what?
Stayed in New Guinea. Lived on the beach. Thank God, anyway, we weren't there all winter.
A few years ago, we were up north in Canada, in Alberta, this one-street town off the Pouce Coupe River. Dark the whole time, October to March, and fuck all to do except read and listen to CBC radio. Had to drive 50 clicks to do our washing. Still, he laughed, loads better than Ukraine. Miami Beach, compared.
What does your dad do again?
Drink, mainly, said Boris, sourly.
He should meet my dad, then. Again, the sudden, explosive laugh, almost like he was spitting over you.
Yes, brilliant. And whores?
Wouldn't be surprised,
I said, after a small, startled pause. Though not too much my dad did shocked me. I had never quite envisioned him hanging out in the live girls and gentlemen's club joints we sometimes passed on the highway. The bus was emptying out. We were only a few streets from my house.
Hey, this is my stop up here, I said.
Want to come home with me and watch television?
Said Boris.
Well, oh, come on. No one's there, and I've got SOS Iceberg on DVD.
11. The school bus didn't actually go all the way out to the edge of Canyon Shadows, where Boris lived. It was a 20-minute walk to his house from the last stop, in blazing heat, through streets awash with sand. Though there were plenty of foreclosure and for-sale signs on my street, At night, the sound of a car radio traveled for miles. Still, I was not aware quite how eerie Canyon Shadows got at its farthest reaches, a toy town dwindling out at desert's edge under menacing skies. Most of the houses looked as if they had never been lived in. Others, unfinished, had raw-edged windows without glass in them. They were covered with scaffolding and grayed with blown sand, with piles of concrete and yellowing construction material out front. The boarded-up windows gave them a blind, battered, uneven look, as of faces beaten and bandaged. As we walked, the air of abandonment grew more and more disturbing, as if we were roaming some planet depopulated by radiation or disease.
"They built this shit way too far out," said Boris. "Now the desert is taking it back, and the banks," he laughed. "Fuck Thoreau, huh? This whole town is like a big fuck you to Thoreau.
I'll tell you who's fucked. People who own these houses. Can't even get water out to a lot of them. They all get taken back because people can't pay. That's why my dad rents our place so bloody cheap."
"Huh," I said, after a slight, startled pause. It had not occurred to me to wonder how my father had been able to afford quite such a big house as ours.
"My dad digs mines," said Boris unexpectedly.
"Sorry?"
He raked the sweaty dark hair out of his face.
"People hate us everywhere we go, because they promise the mine won't harm the environment, and then the mine harms the environment. But here,"
he shrugged in a fatalistic, Russianate way,
"my God, this fucking sandpit, who cares?"
"Huh," I said, struck by the way our voices carried down the deserted street.
"It's really empty down here, isn't it?"
"Yes, a graveyard. Only one other family living here. Those people down there. Big truck out front, see? Illegal immigrants, I think."
"You and your dad are legal, right?" It was a problem at school. Some of the kids weren't. There were posters about it in the hallways. He made a ridiculous sound.
"Of course. The mine takes care of it. Or somebody. But those people down there, maybe 20, 30 of them, all men, all living in one house? Drug dealers, maybe.
You think?"
"Something very funny going on," said Boris darkly. "That's all I know."
Boris's house, flanked by two vacant lots overflowing with garbage, was much like Dad and Zandra's. Wall-to-wall carpet, spanking new appliances, same floor plan, not much furniture. But indoors, it was much too warm for comfort. The pool was dry, with a few inches of sand at the bottom, and there was no pretense of a yard, not even cactuses. All the surfaces, the appliances, the counters, the kitchen floor, were lightly filmed with grit.
"Something to drink?"
said Boris, opening the refrigerator to a gleaming rank of German beer bottles.
"Oh, wow, thanks.
In New Guinea?"
said Boris, wiping his forehead with the back of his hand.
"When I lived there, yeah, we had a bad flood. Snakes, very dangerous and scary. Unexploded mine shells from Second World War floating up in the yard. Many geese died. Anyway," he said, cracking open a beer, "all our water went bad. Typhus. All we had was beer. Pepsi was all gone. Lucozade was all gone. Iodine tablets gone, 3 whole weeks, my dad and me, even the Muslims, nothing to drink but beer. Lunch, breakfast, everything. That doesn't sound so bad."
He made a face.
"Had a headache the whole time.
Local beer, in New Guinea, very bad tasting. This is the good stuff. There's vodka in the freezer, too."
I started to say yes, to impress him. But then I thought of the heat and the walk home and said,
"No, thanks."
He clinked his bottle against mine.
"I agree. Much too hot to drink it in the day. My dad drinks it so much, the nerves are gone dead in his feet."
"Seriously?"
"It's called..."
He screwed up his face in an effort to get the words out. "Peripheral neuropathy," pronounced by him as
peripheral neuropathy. In Canada, in hospital, they had to teach him to walk again. He stood up. He fell on the floor. His nose is bleeding. Hilarious.
Sounds entertaining, I said, thinking of the time I'd seen my own dad crawling on his hands and knees to get ice from the fridge.
Very. What does yours drink, your dad?
Scotch. When he drinks. Supposedly he's quit now.
Ha! Said Boris as if he'd heard this one before. My dad should switch. Good scotch is very cheap here. Say, want to see my room?
I was expecting something on the order of my own room, and I was surprised when he opened the door into a sort of ragtag, tented space, reeking of stale Marlboros, books piled everywhere, old beer bottles and ashtrays and heaps of old towels and unwashed clothes spilling over on the carpet. The walls billowed with printed fabric, yellow, green, indigo, purple, and a red hammer and sickle flag hung over the batik-draped mattress. It was as if a Russian cosmonaut had crashed in the jungle and fashioned himself a shelter of his nation's flag and whatever native sarongs and textiles he could find.
You did this? I said.
I folded up and put it in a suitcase, said Boris, throwing himself down on the wildly colored mattress.
Takes only 10 minutes to put it up again. Do you want to watch SOS Iceberg?
Sure.
Awesome movie. I've seen it 6 times. Like when she gets in her plane to rescue them on the ice?
But somehow we never got around to watching SOS Iceberg that afternoon. Maybe because we couldn't stop talking long enough to go downstairs and turn on the television. Boris had had a more interesting life than any person of my own age I had ever met. It seemed that he had only infrequently attended school, and those of the very poorest sort. Out in the desolate places where his dad worked, often there were no schools for him to go to.
There are tapes, he said, swigging his beer with one eye on me, and tests to take. Except you have to be in a place with the internet, and sometimes like far up in Canada or Ukraine, we don't have that.
So what do you do? He shrugged.
Read a lot, I guess.
A teacher in Texas, he said, had pulled a syllabus off the internet for him.
They must have had a school in Alice Springs.
Boris laughed.
Sure they did,
he said, blowing a sweaty strand of hair out of his face.
But after my mom died, we lived in Northern Territory for a while. Arnhem Land. Town called Karmiwalag. Town so called. Miles in the middle of nowhere. Trailers for the miners to live in and a petrol station with a bar in back. Beer and whiskey and sandwiches. Anyway, wife of Mick that ran the bar, Judy, her name was. All I did, he took a messy slug of his beer. All I did every day was watch soaps with Judy and stay behind the bar with her at night while my dad and his crew from the mine got thrashed.
Couldn't even get television during monsoon. Judy kept her tapes in the fridge so they wouldn't get ruined.
Ruined how?
Mold growing in the wet? Mold on your shoes, on your books?
He shrugged.
Back then I didn't talk so much as I do now because I didn't speak English so well. Very shy, sat alone, stayed always to myself. But Judy? She talked to me anyway, and was kind, even though I didn't understand a lick of what she said.
Every morning I would go to her. She would cook me my same nice fry. Rain, rain, rain. Sweeping, washing dishes, helping to clean the bar. Everywhere I followed like a baby goose. This is cup, this is broom, this is bar stool. This pencil. That was my school. Television. Duran Duran tapes and Boy George. Everything in English.
McLeod's Daughters was her favorite program. Always we watched together, and when I didn't know something, she explained to me. And we talked about the sisters, and we cried when Claire died in the car wreck, and she said if she had a place like Drover's, she would take me to live there and be happy together. And we would have all the women to work for us like the McLeods. She was very young and pretty. Curly blonde hair and blue stuff on her eyes. Her husband called her slut and horse's arse, but I thought she looked like Jody on the show. All day long she talked to me and sang, taught me the words of all the jukebox songs. Dark in the city, the night is alive. Soon I had developed quite proficiency. Speak English, Boris. I had a little English from school in Poland. Hello, excuse me, thank you very much. But 2 months with her, I was chatter, chatter, chatter. Never stopped talking since. She was very nice and kind to me always, even though she went in the kitchen and cried every day, because she hated Carmiwalag so much. It was getting late, but still hot and bright out.
Say, I'm starving,
said Boris, standing up and stretching so that a band of stomach showed between his fatigues and ragged shirt. Concave, dead white, like a starved saint's. What's to eat?
Bread and sugar.
You're kidding. Boris yawned, wiped red eyes.
You never ate bread with sugar poured on it?
Nothing else? He gave a weary-looking shrug. I have a coupon for pizza. Fat lot of good. They don't deliver this far out.
I thought you had a cook where you used to live.
Yeah, we did. In Indonesia. Saudi Arabia, too. He was smoking a cigarette. I'd refused the one he offered me. He seemed a little trashed, drifting and bopping around the room like there was music on, although there wasn't.
Very cool guy named Abdul Fattah.
That means servant of the opener of the gates of sustenance. Well, look, let's go to my house then. He flung himself down on the bed with his hands between his knees.
Don't tell me the slag cooks.
No, but she works in a bar with a buffet. Sometimes she brings home food and stuff.
Brilliant,
said Boris, reeling slightly as he stood. He'd had 3 beers and was working on a fourth. At the door, he took an umbrella and handed me one. What's this for? He opened it and stepped outside.
Cooler to walk under, he said, his face blue in the shade. And no sunburn.
12. Before Boris, I had borne my solitude stoically enough, without realizing quite how alone I was. And I suppose if either of us had lived in an even halfway normal household, with curfews and chores and adult supervision, we wouldn't have become quite so inseparable, so fast. But almost from that day, we were together all the time, scrounging our meals and sharing what money we had. In New York, I had grown up around a lot of worldly kids, kids who'd lived abroad and spoke 3 or 4 languages, who did summer programs at Heidelberg and spent their holidays in places like Rio or Innsbruck or Cap d'Antibes. But Boris, like an old sea captain, put them all to shame. He had ridden a camel. He had eaten witchetty grubs, played cricket, caught malaria, lived on the street in Ukraine, but for 2 weeks only. Set off a stick of dynamite by himself, swum in Australian rivers infested with crocodiles. He had read Chekhov in Russian, and authors I'd never heard of in Ukrainian and Polish. He had endured midwinter darkness in Russia, where the temperature dropped to 40 below, endless blizzards, snow and black ice. The only cheer, the green neon palm tree that burned 24 hours a day outside the provincial bar where his father liked to drink. Though he was only a year older than me, 15, he'd had actual sex with a girl in Alaska, someone he'd bummed a cigarette off in the parking lot of a convenience store. She'd asked him if he wanted to sit in her car with her, and that was that.
But you know what,
he said, blowing smoke out of the corner of his mouth.
I don't think she liked it very much.
Did you?
God, yes. Although, I'm telling you, I know I wasn't doing it right. I think was too cramped in the car.
Every day, we rode home on the bus together. At the half-finished community center on the edge of Desatoya Estates, where the doors were padlocked and the palm trees stood dead and brown in the planters,
There was an abandoned playground where we bought sodas and melted candy bars from the dwindling stock in the vending machines, sat around outside on the swings, smoking and talking. His bad tempers and black moods, which were frequent, alternated with unsound bursts of hilarity. He was wild and gloomy,